Welcome to the Plant-Based Canada Podcast. Join us as we talk with experts to explore the field of nutritional sciences and how our food choices impact our health and the environment. We sit down with Canadian doctors, dietitians, athletes, climate experts, and more to break down the evidence behind a whole foods plant-based diet and discuss the practical steps you can take in your effort to shift toward a healthier lifestyle. Dr. Bhikkhu Jethalal is a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. He graduated from the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa in 1968. He completed his internal medicine and allergy training in 1978 in Canada. He was appointed chief of staff at the Bowmanville Memorial Hospital in 1984, and subsequently on staff as consultant in the Department of Internal Medicine at the Scarborough Grace Hospital in 1985. He has almost 45 years of experience in internal medicine and allergies. And you can also check out Dr. Jethalal's son, Nital, in episode 45 of the Plant-Based Canada podcast, in which we discuss plant-based eating patterns in the GTA. If you enjoy this episode, please consider supporting our show through the link at the bottom of the show notes, or you can donate directly through our website. Dr. Jethalal, thank you so much for joining the Plant-Based Canada podcast this morning. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So let's start with the big question. What got you interested in medicine in the first place?
It wasn't really me. It was my parents. I was born into a strict Hindu vegetarian family in South Africa. And sadly, my parents lost three toddlers, three sisters, under the age of three because of lack of medical treatment. And all three died on the journey to India. In those days, the only affordable way to go to India was by boat, by ship. And there were these two British steamships, Karanja and Kampala. And my mom had to bury them at sea. One died of a childhood illness, febrile convulsion, things like that. They were eminently treatable. So they were... When they had three boys after the three girls, they were determined to steer at least whoever listens into medicine. And the way they did that was my dad befriended a local physician who was also an Indian doctor, a GP. And he would take me there on Sundays during my high school days, or pep talks, what would I want to do, and so on. So I got interested. My mom was very determined. And she had one other major reason. She almost died in her GP's office after they used penicillin as an injection for a respiratory infection. She turned out to be anaphylactic. And so it was a very close call. And the parents steered us in two directions. Number one, academics. And number two, they focused on eating right, eating healthy. And so I chose my parents right, I guess. I don't know.
That's a very tragic backstory. Why did you decide to leave South Africa, and what was the impetus to come to Canada?
I was in London, England, for postgraduate studies. I did 3 years in South Africa. I wanted to get the British MRCP, and there's a word I like to use, which I'll point out throughout my interview: synchro destiny. Not sure if you heard the word, but it's a word coined by Deepak Chopra about meaningful coincidences. Coincidences that turn out to have a purpose or a real meaning, which you could never have designed yourself. The good Lord made it happen. Here's the example. So I was in London, England, doing my MRCP, and my one of my British colleagues, who was also writing the same exam, told me, listen, I'm going to be going across the pond to write the Canadian exams. I said naively, what is the pond? And I had no idea about Canada. It was not on my radar. But he urged me, he said, it's the same materials to study. You'll be fresh. Let's make the trip. So something inside my heart just went with the flow, and I landed May 23rd, 1972 in Toronto. I didn't know too many people, but I did have one contact from an old medical student friend of mine who said, if you ever go to Canada, look up, there are three or four South African doctors at his clinic. Albany King. Anyway, cut a long story short, fell in love with the city. I wrote my Canadian exams in, called LMCC. I called my wife from the Bloor intersection with this, the university, the stadium, the call box. And I reverse called her and I said, look, this place is beautiful. She went along with it, fortunately. We were not even married, actually. She was my fiance. And so that is the first thing, the attraction to Canada, which happened fortuitously. But back story was 3 years after graduation, that was 1970, 69, I was a medical student and you do internship. As an intern, you do get paid, but you'll be paid about half the full qualified doctor. So when I went to pick up my first paycheck, I remember I worked in a very large black hospital, largest in the Southern Hemisphere, King Edward VIII Hospital in Durban. Whites and black doctors worked side by side. Patients, this is a very strange apartheid era. I don't know if you know much about apartheid, but strangely, white and black doctors could work and examine only black patients together. So it's a black hospital with a mixture of different doctors. We were not allowed as a medical student or even as a doctor post-qualification to examine or touch a white patient. It was illegal. So my first paycheck, we all were having coffee and tea, I went to pick up our paycheck. My paycheck was half of my white colleagues who did the same job. And then it hit me straight in the face that this is apartheid, except that you are a second class citizen. And then when that feeling was still in me, and then I found something I really fell in love with, it was an easy move to Canada. I knew I wouldn't bring up my family, my kids as second class citizens.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad I made the move.
That's quite appalling to hear that. And that's not that long ago either, that you said 1969, 1970, that was still
that's
happening.
That's right. It also helped for me to be born into a vegetarian family.
So yeah. So that was another question. So I wanted to ask, obviously, about what was it about lifestyle medicine that you went into, but also I guess there was already some history there for you being born into a vegetarian family. So that might have helped you along that way.
It certainly did. But there was another thing to yesterday. So just to give you a few years in Canada, I went to GP practice for 2-3 years. And I did not like this revolving door medicine. It wasn't satisfying. But I had 3 years of postgrad training under my belt already, with a 1 year in London, England, which the Canadian college recognized, fortunately. Remember now, South Africa, you're very young, but South Africa was put on the world stage on the medical map through a doctor called Christine Barnard. He did the world's first heart transplant, and so became very famous. He put the Stellenbosch University right on the center stage. So we South African graduates were very welcome into Canada, red carpet. I, in fact, landed on Boxing Day in 73, and the next day I was on call for the Albany Clinic. So I did a practice with GP, but I wasn't very happy. And I kept my eyes wide open as to what comes open, what opens up for my fourth year residency. And it only came up, and I grabbed the opportunity. I did a 1 year stint at the Toronto East Young Hospital, wrote my Canadian exams, got through. So then I became an internist. And then I went into practice. It's a long story, but I went to practice. And one day, my secretary, I was having lunch, she brought in the mail for me to look at. And on top of the pile was the Lancet. And the article, reversing heart disease by lifestyle change by Dean Ornish, caught my eye. I was so intrigued, I forgot about lunch. I read the article, I picked up the phone, and I called Dean in Sausalito, California, and I said, look, I'm so-and-so, practicing internist. I'm very interested. I'm very excited about what you've done. As a medical student, I could never defend why I didn't eat eggs. I happened to be lean and mean, like Dean is, or Neil Barnard is. So now I said, Eureka! I got a scientific rubber stamp for the things I was looking for. So I asked Dean, listen, can I ask you a personal favor? Can I come to your retreat and see how you treat people? I said, sure, come along, bring your wife, come. So I went to his retreat. This is in 1991, 92. I was in practice quite a while. And to immerse yourself with another 400 or 500 patients who were all there for medical help. There was a cardiologist from Texas who didn't want to bypass and he was there. And then to witness in front of your eyes what's going on till the end of the week, how diabetics are coming off the insulin, or how hypertensives are improving, or how the chest pain improves. This left an indelible impression in my mind. And I said to myself, this is worth pursuing. Why can't we do this in Canada? So I asked Dean at the end of the week, I said, look, thank you. I've learned a lot. I know how to do this, but we don't have the setup. We don't have teamwork. Will you come and talk to us in Toronto? And he agreed. Now I returned and I was buzzing with excitement. How do I do this? What do I do? What's the maximum mileage I can get out of bringing him into Toronto? Well, there was another synchronicity moment in my life. I was a Rotarian. And just that year, I got a phone call to say somebody in the Rotary Club wanted to nominate me as the president. I was drooling. I said, of course, I'll take it. So then I became the president of the Toronto Don Valley Rotary Club. And I thought to myself, I had sleepless nights. I'm so excited. How do I marry these two things in my mind? I took on the presidency of the Rotary Club. I've got this Dinonish thing cooking. And I said, you know what? As a president, you get to call the shots. So at my first board meeting, I told him how excited I was about the project I wanted to do under the banner of Rotary Club. And the advantage of the banner, Clint, is that the networking, there's nothing like it. Any of the service clubs, you've got a district within the province, and you can spread the word of mouth through internal Rotary newsletters. So I could foresee how I could make it into a giant project, something I didn't imagine. And that's what happened. The board was initially skeptical. They didn't know who this Ornish guy is. And mind you, he wasn't that popular in those years. He just hit the stage with his first article. So I said to another board meeting, look, I would like to sponsor this guy. I've met him, I know what he does, and I like prevention more than I like treating cures. I was tired of acute MI and eMERGE and doing a pacemaker. I did all that. So they said, Bhikkhu, you expect the public to pay $100 a ticket to come and listen to somebody? This is in 1990, early 1990s. I said, yeah. She said, oh, what's your target audience? How many are you expecting? I said, let's start with 1,000. They balked. I said, are you kidding? How are you going to get this 1,000 people? Well, I said, we'll work it out through the publicity and so on. Then I'll publicize through my OMA. I'll get everybody involved. So you get the medical association, the doctors, and the Rotarians, and then the public itself. Who doesn't want to live long or post heart attack? So fast forward a few months, Mega Gala was announced. I went to the Harbour Castle Hilton for the convention center. We sold 1,200 tickets. I got the Rotary Club involved to match funds from Chicago Rotary International. So whatever funds I raised as charity, they would meet dollar for dollar. The board, my Rotary board agreed they will divide the funds into two. One for a cause in South Africa, which is my heart, and two for a cause in Toronto, where we are based. And I explained to them, look, I do feel guilty. South Africa is my birth country, trained me as a doctor. And the moment I graduated, I scooted out of the country. And I want to do something for them. So they agreed. We did a project. It was very, very successful. We were sold out. Dean Ornish was amazing. We actually, it was not just a lecture because I said, you know what, let's walk the talk. Let's provide a dinner that matches the talk. So I went to the manager at the Harbour Castle West and I said to him, look, can you prepare a vegan meal or a plant-based meal? He says, we've never done that. I said, well, I'll help you. I'll help you with some recipes and so on. He said, no, we don't do that. We don't take outside help. It'll be an insult to our chefs. I said, look, I'm bringing in 200 people at $100 a pop, and I'm not even asking you what your cost is for the meal. Are you still interested? And of course, money talks. So they prepared a meal out of Dean Ornish's book. We picked out a few recipes, the watermelon salad, the pasta dish, and so on. It was amazing. People ate well. It was totally vegan. And by that time, I'm forgetting one or two things. Around that time, after we'd invited the prep to the talk was 6 months down the road, selling tickets, one of the editors of the Toronto Star got a wind of my interest in diet and nutrition, called me up and asked me if I were doing a series of articles for the Toronto Star on nutrition. So I said, sure, after the talk, we'll get together. So in the meantime, I said, look, you owe me a favor if I do this. I want you to publicize this event. So we were written up in the editorial of the Toronto Star, The Low-Fat World Comes to Toronto. And all about the Rotary Club and what you're doing, and the funds are going to seven South African black student schooling. Lo and behold, the phones didn't stop ringing. I mean, when you get in the best publicity is the one that you don't pay for. When somebody else writes an article about you. So I was very fortunate. I mean, I didn't expect the patience with the Toronto Star pitching up at my doorstep. That's synchronous destiny. I don't know how many events I've told you so far. But anyway, that's how we had the event. That's how the word went out. And it was the most satisfying event I've ever done in my life. Even more satisfying was what followed. So the Toronto Dawn Bears Rotary Club, you have to partner with a local Rotary Club who handles all the extra funding. You provide the check. And that was the Durban Rotary Club. So I was invited by the Durban Rotary Club a year later to open these seven new schools. And imagine a lady, a white lady, when I was in Durban, I was staying with my mother. She came to pick me up in a convertible red BMW, take me to a black township to open up these schools. And my mom saw me through the window of the apartment and she said, holy smokes, I hope this guy comes back alive. Anyway, so the beautiful story, I went there, I was sitting on the floor with the kids, playing with the toys that my club provided. The school was all renovated. It was such a fulfilling moment in my life, honestly. Hinduism is that our lives are divided into 25-year quarters. First 25, you educate yourself and get a career. Second 25 is marriage, children, raising a family. The third 25, you give back. You give back to the community. And the last quarter, of course, is for introspection and self-reflection. And here I was fitting right into the third quarter of life. So yes, so that's how Dean Ornish happened. And that's how I became totally vegan. At birth in South Africa, I was a vegetarian, lacto, not ovo. Lacto-vegetarian. As you know, milk is a big deal in India. Milk is, Lord Krishna was known for eating butter. So, but I can make kulfi out of oat milk or almond milk. And my friends don't even know. I make tea out of oat milk. So we have alternatives, which we didn't have in those days.
That's an
But
amazing
nice.
story. That's an amazing story. I want to ask. Well, first, I just want to mention you. I love that in the beginning of the story, and I know it was before Dean Ornish was advisor to the Clintons and all that. But it was there's been a couple people I've talked to where they've brought up some of the grandfathers of the plant-based diet, like Ornish or Campbell or Esselstyn, and they talk about contacting them years back, and it's as easy as picking up a phone and calling
Yes.
them and talking to them, which is amazing because now it's quite difficult and there's a lot of hoops you need to jump through to contact these people directly. So
Right.
that's fantastic that you just call them up like that. I want to ask, so obviously it was received well, and then you went on to influence all these other things, but what was the reception like from the medical community when you did this? Did you get any pushback?
I got pushback, not from the medical community. I got pushback from the dairy industry. The nutritionist from the dairy board called me up for a challenge. Would I go on a talk show with a head-to-head? So I said, of course I would. I mean, I had the science to back me up. Why wouldn't I? Then I said, I've been in this game quite a bit. And I know politics, how they're played. I know how elections are done. I know how you canvass. So I said, okay. So we set a date. The two-part series. I think it's Talk 10-10. I forget now, many, many moons ago. And one of my second article in the Toronto Star, was entitled Milk Dash A Big White Lie. And that had caught the eye of a lot of people, but particularly the dairy industry. So I wasn't very popular. Anyway, I said to my secretary, put out a few charts, give me top six charts of patients with severe asthma, eczema, severe allergic rhinitis, who have got better when I took them off milk. And she said, sure I would. I did my phone calling. This is politicking at its best. Told these people, look, I'm doing a head show. I would like you to call in after the talk and express your honest opinion. And when they did that, when I did the radio show, my patients calling in to say how much better they got when they stopped milk and eczema improved, it still didn't work. I didn't even have to argue. They did the debate. So I got pushback from them, but never heard back. I'm not very popular, honestly, to tell you the truth, with my local pharmacist, because I take more people off drugs than I put on drugs. I mean, polypharmacy is a huge problem, particularly in the seniors population, and I see side effects. As in, the other hat I do wear, the other extra training in allergies as a postgraduate student in San Francisco. So today, in my semi-retired position, I see a lot of allergy patients, two mornings a week, Tuesday, Thursday. And these are people often coming with side effects of drugs. And when they land on my lap, it's so nice to take them off a pill and see the diabetes still gets better, and the hives improve, or the angioedema improves, or the rash goes away. So yeah, I want to keep my finger in the pie, so to speak, for that, because I enjoy what I do. I really do.
I had horrible, horrible allergies when I was younger, actually. And it's funny because you've been thinking of treating people from a lifestyle perspective very early on. And I grew up in the US, and I had chronic sinusitis. I had sinusitis maybe every other month. I would get a sinus infection, and it was a very bad one. I got used to living that way because I was sick so often that I just didn't call off work. I would just go to work sick like that because I couldn't miss any more days. But every time I would go to a doctor, family doctor, the question would always be about smoke. Do you smoke? And things like that. I was never ever asked in all the years what I was eating. And then at one point for me, it was, I think I saw something online about dairy allergies and sinuses. And I was in university at the time and then independently checked to see if I could find any connectors. And it turns out there was a wealth of information about it. And then that's when I that what that's what led me to cut out dairy in my diet. And it was like a miracle that I just never got a sinus infection again. It was wild, but also kind of infuriating that information existed, but yet it wasn't. Nobody was really practicing the lifestyle side of things like you were.
Exactly. Well, the word lifestyle is a modern terminology. If you look at Dean Ornish's initial study, he did take people off smoking, he did plant-based diet, of course. He did exercise them, and he told them about stress management, yoga, and meditation. So that's, in a way, a package of lifestyle. But to duplicate what he did in Toronto was so difficult. I tell you, I was invited to give talks by the Heart and Stroke Foundation, by the Toronto Vegetarian Association, by the temples that all knew me in Toronto, and so on. So I keep telling them, look, I'd love to come, but if you're serving anything, it must walk my talk. if you're going to serve chicken wings, don't involve me. I'll say goodbye to you. But despite all that, particularly the hot and strong, they continue serving garbage food, even if they're snacks. You know, and I warned them ahead of time because this is one of the conditions of being honest is coming to Toronto, and he wasn't shy about it. And so I said to them, look, this is not working for me. I'm sorry. If I walk into the hospital cafeteria today, Clint, I'm ashamed to see a pop machine or Tim Hortons with donuts. I mean, come on. But when you look back at the big picture, there was a lag time between the science with tobacco smoke and the implementation and banning of smoke. There was a 40-year lag and 5,000 studies. Well, and we lost a lot of millions of people died. We don't have to do that in this day and age because we had a similar situation with food today. Science is up. All these people, including Gregor, are doing wonderful work. I mean, for Gregor to do a free volunteer work on his website, podcast, talks, it's amazing. So today we have the digital age where information is trickled out right to the public, which we didn't have that with the tobacco smoke. So now people are demanding. I had a patient who called on Friday, left a message for him to return the call. And I did that yesterday. She came from Ottawa to see me. And the reason was that she had moved from Toronto, and a local GP referred her to me. She's 15 years old, severe chronic eczema of the total body, stage four. And I'd seen pediatrician and dermatologist. It didn't improve. So I saw her and I sent her back and I said, email me when one month is up. Let me know your progress. You don't have to drive down all the way. So that is the return call. I called her back and she's 90% cleared up on removing dairy, nuts, chocolates, and all processed junk. I mean, what more can be satisfying? Now, for me, sure, the talks were not working out because the food wasn't matching. But now, through one patient, I've influenced the entire family. The whole family has got an animal dairy. They switched over to plant-based dairy. I didn't have to convince them. So I'm at that advantageous situation where people come for help. Their back is to the wall. They've got drug side effects, and they've seen three other doctors before me. That's when I pull out my whole food plant-based hat, and I offer it to them gently. I used a lot of handouts because initially, as you know, trying to do justice to a patient and tell him everything about plant-based takes an hour, which I don't have. So I spent 15 minutes with them. I tell them, I'm going to give you the tools. I'm not driving with you on the 401 to Montreal. I'll show you the way how to get there. You make the journey. Call me when you get there. We'll chat again. So I give them Dean Ornish's lectures or whatever is relevant to their cause. Oh, there's a very nice one on hypertension or diabetes. Neil Barnard's lecture on diabetes is fantastic. He explains his whole theory about why we call it insulin resistant. It's not insulin deficiency. And unless people get and grasp that idea that, yeah, it is resistant because the insulin is not able to enter the cell because the cell is full of fat globules the gut is blocking it. It's like you're entering a house. And you got the right key in the right door, and you can't put the key in because somebody has stuck some chewing gum into your lock. So, if you get all this saturated fat junk out of your diet, the insulin will just flow in, sugars come down, goodbye, diabetes. Yeah, this anecdotal example of this girl was right on the heels of what you told me. So, I enjoy what I do, and I think the lifestyle, I got to give credit to Dean Ornish. Without him, I wouldn't have the scientific. But now, all the other new people that are coming in. The ones you mentioned, Neil Barnard, and now we got some new people really playing. Suresh Tenchik, I don't know if you heard of her. STANCIC. She spoke at the ICNM International Conference of Nutrition and Medicine. So people like her, people like Brooke Goldner, have you heard of her?
Yes, yeah.
So these are new people, but Suresh Tenchik was particularly impressive in Washington when Nita and I attended. And if you listen to a doctor who had the disease, recover from the disease, go on stage and tell you what they did, that's compelling. Very compelling. So she was wheelchair bound with MS. Mayo Clinic couldn't help her. Harvard couldn't help her. She was on steroids and biologics. And here she was, standing with us on the stage, in front of our eyes, telling us her journey. on how she hit the research on autoimmune diseases. So that's the new kid on the block. I mean, you got your heart disease, strokes, and cancer. But what about all these autoimmune diseases, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's? So she left an indelible impression on both me and Nita. We were both there together.
Well, it's important when doctors walk the walk. Like you said earlier, it's important to be the lighthouse, right?
Absolutely. But you know what's most satisfying today, honestly, Clint, is the passion that Nita has in his belly. And that kid, I'll tell you a quick story. We were in India 2-3 years back. And you know what's a goshala? A goshala is a protective shelter for stray cows. He would enter there, just walking to see my relative, my aunt. They live in a little village. And he said, "Dad, let's go inside." And he would pet the cows. He was a mid-teen. He would pet the cows and he would like to feed them. When I bought my first car in Canada, my brand new car, Nathan was at UCC, still high school. And he wouldn't sit in my car. I said, "What's the matter, son?" He said, "Dad, why did you buy leather seats?" I said, "I didn't. It came with it." He said, "No, that's not good enough." He took the bus for 6 months until I had to explain to him. A non-leather seat is a special order. But that's the kind of principle he has. My cousin in Dallas has a leather factory. Nathan goes there to visit. He wouldn't enter that factory. This is on principle. It doesn't align with my thinking, Uncle. I'm so sorry. For him to be now an activist, he's a policy analyst and economist, policy advisor for plant-based. You know everything he does in VegTO, TV Bank.
Yes.
So he makes me proud, Kent.
You're right. He's very passionate, and I've talked to him a few times, and he's really fantastic. And one thing that's really great is besides the passion, he has all of the technical information. Like, he has that all down pat. So
yes,
it's not just a passion project. It's passion that's informed by evidence, and that's super important. And he has that. Yeah. And a lot of newer activists and doctors, I think, have that in spades as well. And I think it's super important. And in, like you said, the age of information, when data is flying around everywhere, it's important to be able to parse through that and have somebody like him lead the way. I want to ask you, so with your patients, so you've been treating patients for quite a while, and you go back to the 70s and 4 decades, and then you fast forward to now. I'm curious, from when you started and then now, how things have changed in terms of patient reception to lifestyle medicine and some of the tenets that you've been teaching them about lifestyle medicine. Has it over time gotten easier for them to accept some of the suggestions that you make, especially in terms of diet?
Yes.
I know it's more acceptable now for people to talk about plant-based diets, and there's more and more and more evidence. There's the Eat Lancet study, the IPCC. There's all of this wealth of data now, but I'm curious if you go back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, what that was like compared to now talking to patients.
This is a very exciting time to practice medicine. Patients are receptive. There's a shining light at the end of the long tunnel. I mean, if you just take, I'll give you 2-3 examples. For the Canadian health minister recently stood her ground against the lobbyists when you food your guideline. And Merck and dairy were removed as an independent food group. And she actually mentions in that guideline that she emphasized shifting towards plant-based food is recommended. Clint, this is huge. For them to remove the dairy industry out, that was huge for me. Second example, the city of New York mayor, Eric Adams, got all the public hospitals to make their meals plant-based by default. If you want meat, you have to ask for it. 80% didn't ask. They're happy to remain default. This should happen in hospital cafeterias here. It should happen in school cafeterias over here. But New York has set a shining example for other cities to follow. Nital is working very hard to get the city of Toronto to follow the default option, greener by default. Why not? The third example that really is a good one to quote as a country, forget the city, and is Finland. Something happened after World War II in Finland. People went wild, partying, and very happy. They picked up, literally picked up. And the cardiac deaths in the next 2 decades peaked in Finland. A lot of other European countries as well. So eventually they got serious. There was a project launched, you might have heard this, 1988, I think. Dairy to berry. Dairy farms to berry farms. And this became a very friendly, competitive, cholesterol-lowering competition. Now, how did they do? Well, take the figures for the next decade, what happened? There was an 80% drop in cardiac mortality across the country. Now, what an example. This translates to 6 to 7 years of an extension of someone's life expectancy. You know, you mentioned Dr. Gregory, I'm sure you were there 2 3 weeks back. He ended his talk by saying, let's get the ball rolling. Let's all become activists. Let's petition our local school, your local hospital. Let's get involved. Today, and the movement is growing, I can tell you that. You can get an oat milk latte at any way you want to. Reception for somebody at a hotel. And one of the options, they had an independent vegan menu. This is massive. You know, where the hotels are recognizing. So I think we encourage the public to get involved, volunteer, vote with your pocketbook. The sales of animal dairy is plummeting. And yet there are no ads for oat milk, soya milk, almond milk. They don't need to advertise. So I think there's a lot of hope left. Public is more receptive. I tell my patients, just work with me for a month. You've had this intermittent angioedema of your lips and tongue. I think it's one of your blood pressure pills. I'm going to stop it. I'll give you an alternative that doesn't do that. But at the end of the day, my ultimate goal is to stop your pills and let medicine be your treatment. They are receptive to that. They say, Doc, I've been talking to my doctor. I hate this 8 pills every morning I have to take. When they are receptive, you've got an audience. I see a huge future. Look, to be honest with you, 40 years ago, when I was in medical school in South Africa, my profs used to have cigarettes in the top pocket, unashamed. You could not walk into a doctor's lounge. It was full of smoke. You could barely see faces. Look how far we came today. But we don't have to wait another 40 or 50 years to reach that state. We're going to lose a lot of people. And all these diseases are so eminently treatable. Why not? I normally conclude my patients' talks with two things, if I may. Number one, don't eat anything that walks, swims, or flies. Number two, only eat when you're hungry. Eat natural foods. Eat till you're satisfied, which means only 80% of capacity, not till you stop, and eat slowly. And they say, but wow, this is such common sense. But nobody teaches nutrition, not even in schools or medical school, which is a shame. So I hope the power that maybe will listen to you on it. Number one, recognize lifestyle medicine. By recognize, I mean it should be certifiable, right? So the College of Physicians and Surgeons will recognize it. Number two, OHIP must recognize it. They must start to pay people who practice this way. Because I'm fortunate. As an allergist, I'm wearing two hats. Not too many people are in that situation where I can bill as an allergist, but practice as a lifestyle medicine.
Before we wrap things up, I just want to ask one more question. I want to know what some of the biggest obstacles you've encountered in the medical community, and then also if you see things changing moving forward. It seems that way with the public, like you've said, with your patients, there's a definite shift. But do you see a paradigm shift with the medical community too, in being more receptive, like your patients are, of lifestyle medicine?
Receptive, but not fast enough, Clint. You know, I mean, yeah, sure, there are now international conferences on nutrition that doctors attend. There are cruises, there's a vegan cruise once a year, PCRM. I've done that many times. I encourage my colleagues. My colleagues only listen when they are in trouble. They don't want to take the medication. I tell them, look, would you like to try this for a month? But it's one on one. I tried the mass appeal with Dean Ornish. If he couldn't have, I had a meeting with myself, Dean Ornish, and Tyrone David, and the CEO of Trolley General Hospital, while he was here in 1992. And this is the day after his talk, and I said, Tyrone David, huge name in Trolley. I don't know if you know the name, but he's the leading North American cardiac surgeon. I said, Tyrone, please, you heard the talk. You came to the talk. I made him give the vote of thanks to Dean Ornish. And I said, convince your Trolley General board to at least give us a 6-month experimental trial basis to practice the Dean Ornish program. He said, I'll see what I can do. So we met, and then, of course, lo and behold, nothing happened. The board, you see, here's one thing. The meat and dairy industry is so strong. You cannot ever say, D eat less meat and less dairy. That's haram. That's heresy. So you're fighting a huge lobby. How did you fight the tobacco lobby? Not by fighting the industry. You're not going to win. It's by one education of the public who demanded clean air. So I think this momentum is growing in size. I see things I never saw before in terms of conferences and so on. It's a good sign. And GPs are willing to send me patients, which is a good thing. But it's slow. It hasn't gone to the medical association level yet. Although, I mean, Zahra Qassam is a good example. She is an oncologist. She can shake up the hospital cafeteria where she practices. So those who are whole food based and happen to have a position they can use for betterment, why not?
Doctor, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today. Your story is really amazing. Your journey is really amazing. So it's been fantastic talking with you. Thank you so much for joining the Plant-Based Canada podcast today.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
This podcast featured royalty-free music from bensound.com. A very special thanks to our guests for speaking with us and sharing their insights. And of course, thank you for listening. The Plant-Based Canada podcast is an initiative of the group Plant-Based Canada, which aims to educate the public and health professionals on the evidence-based benefits of plant-based whole food nutrition for individual and planetary health. To learn more about the show, visit our website, www.plantbasedcanada.org, and stay up to date by following us on Instagram and Facebook at plantbasedcanada.org and our Plant-Based Canada YouTube channel. Also, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcasts.